Hello and welcome to Auntie Monkey. I'm Andrew Robertson and today we're going to be talking about one of my favourite topics, which is competition ballooning. And to do that, I'm joined by a very special guest. He is a 2 times world champion and the current US champion. I'm talking about Johnny Petron. Johnny has been ballooning all of his life and he has been at the top of the game in competition ballooning for the last couple of decades. So today we're going to get into some of his background, but also look at what it takes to become a world champion. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Welcome, Johnny, to Auntie Monkey. So thank you for joining us today on one of our very early podcasts.
I'm excited to be here. I wish I was all the way down in Australia with you, but the magic of Skype will make this happen.
And we were just talking off air. We're sort of sitting here watching everybody over in Saga competing at the moment. I can certainly say that I'm sorely jealous. I don't know about yourself.
Yeah, it's the first time in many years of not going over. And I think that I've already decided I'll put it back on the schedule for next year.
Great. Well, hopefully we can all be over there together. I think The last time we saw each other was in the gin bar in the downtown Saga, squeezing about 200 people into a room that only fit about 10 people. So
yeah, and everybody was dumping sake on Red Hartzell's head. So
yep, which is a normal event. Great. Well, today I really want to dive into some of your competition ballooning experience, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the competitions you've competed in, some of your success. But before we do that, I'd really love to dive into some of your background and how you got into ballooning. And one of the things I'm very interested in is you've come from a very large family, and I'd love to know how so many kids in the Petron family can get their balloon licenses with limited resources.
Yeah, I was lucky. My dad bought a balloon when I think it was 1974, so I was just a couple feet tall. So I grew up on the chase crew, kind of went through him getting his license and learning how to fly. And then when we all got old enough, we started flying with other pilots, chasing with other pilots around town, because that was the only time we could get our hands on the burners.
So how many siblings do you have?
There are 11 kids altogether, and about half of us are involved in ballooning in some way, shape, or form.
So was your retrieve vehicle something like the Partridge Family bus?
It was. It wasn't painted as spectacular as that. But yeah, big Dodge van, and there were 4 or 5 of us sitting per seat, and we'd travel around to different balloon festivals all over the country.
So tell me about your first balloon ride. How old were you when you did that?
I barely remember it, but my dad's best friend bought a balloon, and I believe it was over Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States, and I remember just being scared. And Paul doesn't like me to tell this story, but my little brother, he was scared of the burner, so he was hiding behind my mom. But we got to go for a quick balloon flight in an old Balloon Works balloon called the Green Apple in Topeka, Kansas. And I think my dad bought a balloon from his friend before they even hit the ground.
Fantastic. And I'm sure Paul doesn't like that story because you just called him his little brother again.
That's right.
And then in terms of yourself as a kid going through your ballooning life, and I talked to Michael Glenn about this the other day, second generation balloonists typically as children go through phases of enjoying the sport and doing your own thing. What was that like for you?
Everything. We grew up on the chase crew, hanging out with your old man. No one really likes doing that. So as soon as we could, we always wanted to go crew for other pilots. We grew up going to Indianola, Iowa, the national championships, and my dad was never any good. And back in the day, they had 100 balloons would start the week off, and about halfway through, they'd have a cut, and they'd basically send the bottom 50 home. And so we were always having to go to grandma's house the second half of the week. So, we kind of grew up on the balloon crews, and just when we had a chance to get out and do our own thing and get away from flying with dad, we did. And then here we are.
And so when did you start getting your student license and getting your license?
I got my private license in 1989, and actually did quite a bit of training with my sister, Becky. She got her pilot's license. I think she was the first one in the family to have her pilot's license. And I like to say we went and kind of learned how to fly together, and she signed me off to solo and to get my pilot's license.
And how old were you at that stage?
16. In the United States, it's 16 for a private license and 18 for a commercial license.
Right. And then did you, during your sort of college years, did you continue with your flying or did you get other interests at that time?
Yeah, actually, flying is what made my college years kind of limited. I started going to school and kind of used ballooning to kind of help pay for it. And I hated school and I loved flying balloons. So eventually I spent too much time ballooning and kind of left college behind.
I have similar stories, unfortunately.
One of those silly me.
Yes, I know the feeling. So competition, let's dive into that. When did you first sort of get interested in the competition sides? You mentioned going with your dad and potentially being culled halfway through the week. Was that something that you early got into?
A little bit, kind of as a kid. But after I got my license, I flew in a balloon race in Kansas City called the Kansas City Cloud Bus, and it was 30 balloons or so, I think. And I bought an old balloon, borrowed $500 from my sister Cindy, and I had $500 in the bank account, and a local balloonist financed the other $500. So I had an old, nasty old balloon that we flew in a balloon race and flew by a couple targets and threw the baggies. And at the end of the balloon festival, we won it, which was, I didn't really know any better at the time. But a year later, I had sanctioned points and was entered into the national championship in 1990 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I didn't know anything about it other than I had kind of watched my dad make every mistake possible. So I signed up for the David Levin Red Dog School of Competition Ballooning. And that's really where things started to click. And I realized that I loved flying balloons. I loved the competitive aspect of it. And David kind of showed us what it took to do it on a big level and how to really take it seriously. And so kind of from that point on, it's been a way of life.
And you mentioned the competitive side of it. Would you describe yourself as a generally competitive person? So if you're playing Scrabble with friends, are you one that has to win the whole time?
Don't necessarily have to win, but having eight brothers and two sisters, we used to have to compete just to get the attention from our parents or to get seconds at the dinner table. We had to see who could eat the tacos the fastest. So I am a competitive person for sure.
Right. So eating tacos is the trick to becoming a world champion.
Sure.
I thought drinking beer was, so I've obviously got it wrong.
Beer and tacos.
In those early days of your competition flying, how did you go in that first nationals in terms of results? And was that sort of you mentioned it was a learning experience.
Oh, absolutely. Kind of went into it really, really green, but we spent a week with David Levin kind of teaching us tricks and trades. And I think we finished 15th that first year out of, there might've been 50 or 60 pilots and something clicked and I realized I really liked it. So the next couple years, I kind of took what I learned and kept trying and wasn't really making a whole lot of progress. But then I started just analyzing everything and I wrote down all of the tasks that we did. And I started paying attention and investigating and looking at the history and trying to figure out mistakes that I made or what I was good at and what I wasn't good at, what I needed help with. And so it kind of snowballed and escalated into something that I started thinking about time and time and again. And then accidentally qualified for the U.S. Worlds team in Luxembourg. I think it was 1993. It was the first time I'd ever been out of the country. The first time my mom and my brother Paul were on my crew and we all went to Luxembourg and again, didn't really know any better, had never really seen ballooning on an international scale, but just absolutely fell in love with the international aspect of it, representing my country and then meeting people from all over the world that love to do the same thing. So that's really when it took off.
So was there a definitive moment or a moment you can remember where things just started to click in your mind? I mean, you mentioned you're doing all that analysis and writing things down, which I'll get into with you in a minute, but do you remember a moment where, you know, you thought, yeah, you know what, I can do this?
Maybe in 1995 at the U.S. National Championship was the first year I really contended that I had a shot to win. Had a decent, I think I was sitting in second or third place going into the last flight and I came in and just really did good on the last task and did as good as I could possibly do. And I think we still ended up finishing second or third, but it was the first time that I said, I think I really can win this and do it on a big scale.
And there's nothing like stepping on that podium at the end of the event.
Yeah. I went from kind of the outside the top 10 to all of a sudden kind of contending, and that really got the juices flowing, the adrenaline pumping.
So fast forwarding a little bit to you then started actually winning a few nationals. When was the first time you kind of got to the top in the nationals?
1998 was the first time I won the U.S. nationals. And actually it was a long time in between that I didn't win them again for another, seems like 20 years, but yeah, kind of, we consistently started, contending and being right there and on the podium or nearby the podium kind of every year after that.
So I've noticed something as you've been describing and talking about these events, you're always saying we, so you're obviously a team player and you obviously value your crew and team. So can you tell me a little bit about what your team looks like and, you know, generally how it's changed over the years and the types of people that you've brought onto your team?
It's an ever-changing, ever-evolving thing that usually starts out with who can I get to help out. In a perfect world, I've had my brothers, my sisters, other pilots, other champions, kind of anybody that I can get, I try to snag and help out. And there's been national championships that I've gone and, I basically almost pulled somebody out of the crowd, or I'm borrowing a young Hartzell to come stealing out of Joe's crew to drive my truck, or, all the way up to going to the nationals or going to the worlds with a lead vehicle and having two or three members in there or two or three people in my truck and really kind of being overstaffed or overcrewed, if that's a possibility. So it's just kind of was always changing, kind of trying to find the right mix of people that you want to hang out with for 10 days in stressful situations, and people that'll make you better or calm you down or treat you right or have fun with, really.
So yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about the family side of things, because I certainly know that my family is the only people that will tolerate me at a ballooning competition. So, are you the same? Do you get towards the end of the event get tired and stressed?
I like to think that I'm evolving over the years and that I'm getting better at that. And I'm sure there's some people that'll tell you otherwise. But I kind of internalize most things, and I vent on a rare occasion, but I try to take it out and take the blame for things. And any mistakes I make, I let them build up and I'll think about them for the next 2 years. But I try to be a good guy to crew for. I may not drink as much beer during the worlds as some of the guys, but I think we have a fun time.
So you mentioned the Hartzells before, and look, from an outside looking into the U.S. nationals, there's obviously the Donners, the Hartzells, the Petrons, there's the families at the top. What sort of rivalries going on between your teams? I said, well, I've seen you at a world championships when you're kind of all working together, but at a nationals, is it gloves off and everyone's at it?
Yes and no. It's generally friendly. The last 10 years or so, I've kind of teamed up and fly with Joe Hartzell and Rhett Hartzell, and we've had a pretty good run at the nationals the last 10 years between us. It kind of breaks in the Donners, Nick and Chase and Joe Zavada kind of have a group, and Nick's obviously been my number one nemesis through the 2000s, and seems like I finished second place to him about 35 times. So it's a friendly rivalry for the most part.
It's a bit like having scaifes in Australia.
Well, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I was actually going to say that Matt Scaife has provided me a whole list of questions to ask you to get into your brain. So we'll put those ones aside, because I'm sure that's all about stealing secrets. all right. So coming back to your national success, how many times have you won the nationals now?
The BFA Nationals, I've won it 4 times, and so I won it in 1998, and then I've won it 3 of the last 4 years just recently.
And then your brother won the other one, didn't he?
My brother Paul has won 3 of them, I'm pretty sure. So, yeah, we've kind of, Hartzell's, Rhett and Joe, Nick and Chase, and then Paul and I have won quite a few of the Nationals the last 10 or 15 years.
So what's the sibling rivalry like when you're flying against Paul?
Well, yeah, he won his second and his third national championship long before I won my second. So I always joke that holiday dinners I had to kind of put up with him and his sarcasm. But I was very happy to win a few more and not have to listen to his BS anymore.
And then you went and won a world championships and slammed it down, huh?
Yeah, that kind of helps too.
So I guess fast forwarding to the world. So 2006 in Japan, I was fortunate enough to be competing. That was my first world championships and definitely wasn't up the end of the ladder that you were, but that was your first world to win. What did it take to do that?
What did it take to win that? A lot of failure at Worlds and Nationals before that, probably more than anything else, just making mistakes, taking risks. And 2006 was interesting because I hadn't flown much. In fact, I didn't really fly for almost a year prior to that. And I wasn't sure that I was going to even go to Motegi in 2006 until about 90 days prior. So I kind of had to kind of lean on the other teammates that we went to, that went with us that year. I had a great ground crew. I had friends, pilots that were in the main chase vehicle. My brother Maury and his wife were in the lead vehicle. And Team USA was a pretty small team. There were four of us. It was Nick Donner, Joe Hartzell, my brother Paul, and I. So we had a really small, cohesive team. And that was the first year we really kind of had a team manager. Al Nels went over and was a team manager, and he had kind of four of us that he was helping out with wins and information. And it was a year that I didn't fly my best. I wasn't on top of my game, but kind of made some good decisions and cruised along. But I really think between my crew and the other US teammates are why 2006 was successful. And I had been there, I had flown a Motegi a couple times before, so I kind of knew what to expect.
And that was a smaller US team because that year, from memory, there was only about 65, 66 competitors purely because the area wasn't going to support 103 balloons as we normally have.
Yeah, yeah. And Motegi is such a great place to fly. And that's really what convinced me, because I had taken a year off from ballooning to focus on my real estate career. I was trying to be something other than a balloon pilot, and wasn't until the last minute that we decided to go. And it's because Motegi was such a fantastic place to go fly, and Masashi put on such a great event, and it was organized, and it was just impossible to say no to going to Motegi. And I missed that event.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Masashi died a couple of weeks before the event started. So
yeah, it was terrible.
It had a bit of a underlying sadness to that whole event, but yeah, it was still a great one. But coming back, do you think that the reason that you potentially did well was that you, I guess, coming in not thinking you were actually going to go to the last minute, did you have lower expectations on yourself as you went into the event, or was the pressure personally still on?
No, actually, I think the pressure was off, and I definitely think that might have played into it, that I focused more just on the individual task and the individual flight, kind of one task at a time. And I didn't go in having a championship speech prepared or anything like that. It was I just kind of focused on the small things and didn't pay attention to the big stuff. And I don't know if I put a lot of pressure on myself, but I think it was just a kind of a natural combination of being in the right place at the right time, making a couple of the correct decisions when a couple guys in front of me the last couple flights made a different decision, and it all just kind of worked out. And in order to win a big championship like that, you've got to have all kinds of things fall into place. It's not who wins each target or who flies the closest to the middle of it, but it's who continues to make kind of the right decision and avoids the big, huge mistakes.
Sure. And on the mistake front, you never seem to be somebody that tends to get penalties in your competitions. Is that something that you're very conscious of, or is that just purely good luck?
Both. I mean, I try to know that rule book, and I try to use that rule book as much to my advantage as possible. But I hate giving away points because it's detrimental to what we're trying to accomplish. So I try to stop 25 feet above the ground instead of hitting it. I try to kind of cross my T's and dot the I's and not make those mistakes, because that's just it's a waste. So yeah, I definitely focus on not getting penalized.
It's quite interesting. I've been doing some analysis of different countries and different events and looking at penalties. And certainly there's countries like Lithuania and Poland, and you look at their competitions, and I would say 70% of the pilots get some sort of penalty throughout the event. And then some of the other countries, they're a lot cleaner.
I mean, Mike Howard's the king of getting penalties, so as long as I'm not doing what he's doing, we're generally doing all right.
So you watch him go in and then just do exactly the opposite.
Exactly.
Excellent. And with your Japan success towards the end of the event, do you remember when you got into the number one slot? Was it towards right at the end, or was it halfway through the event?
The kind of the last day, we did a morning flight, and it ended with one more evening flight. And before the evening flight, we'd kind of done the math, and I had guessed, or we kind of thought that we were in the lead with about 100 points over, I think it was Joe Hartzell and Uwe Snyder and Nick Donner. That morning, I'd had a good morning, but none of the scores were up. So we went into that evening flight knowing that we were kind of in the lead. So I did send my lead vehicle, and they kept an eye on where Uwe, I think Uwe was the closest one to us, and we were flying with Joe Hartzell, so I knew what he was doing. So that last flight, kind of didn't know for sure, but I felt like we pretty much matched what they did. And so when I landed, I was cautiously optimistic that we had won, but there was no champagne or anything like that, no celebrations until 3 or 4 hours after we landed.
And then what happened once you got that result? Was it party time?
Yes and no. It was pretty late into the night, and it was a long week. We flew all of the flights. So we had some sake and some beer and probably a can of Pringles, and went to bed, and then got up the next morning and had kind of a fun fly-in key grab kind of flight, and landed on the river, a typical Motegi flight.
And then spend the rest of the day cleaning balloons to get them out of the country again.
Exactly.
Great. And then I guess jumping forward again, your second win at the World Championships in Hungary in 2010, how was that different coming in as somebody knowing you can do it? Was the pressure there again, or how did that differ from your first world win?
It was 2010 again was a weird year. 2008 was I got to go to the Worlds as the defending champion. I think we finished 30th or 40th place. I was lost in Austria. I had no idea what was going on. So I kind of got the worry of a repeat out of the way, and I didn't have to worry about that again. So going into Hungary, I think we're kind of refocused, just kind of trying to take it flight by flight. It was before the event started. They had a cyclone move through there, and half of the roads on the competition map were impassable because it was so muddy, and we had strange weather. And it really limited, it kind of changed the dynamic of what the director was able to allow us to do for that week. And that was a week I felt like I would get done, or I'd fly across a target and I'd throw my baggie and we'd be a meter away. And I think that was really good. And then Nick Donner would come in and lay it right in the middle, and my 950 points, I'd lose 40 points to him on every target. So I was flying good, but man, Nick was flying great up until the last flight when things kind of shook up. But it was tough because I felt like I was flying good, and we could never do good enough to catch what Nick was doing.
It's a little bit like going to Saga when you come into a target and drop within a meter, and then another 30 people do exactly the same behind you.
Yeah, there's a mountain of baggies, and you're on you're a meter away, and it's not quite good enough. It's a little disheartening.
Certainly, looking at some of the photos from Hungary, you can picture the queue of balloons lying up for that cross. So
yeah,
and then With that second win, does that mean now that when you're going into competitions that you're putting more pressure on yourself, or is it something in your mind that you're like, well, I've done this before, I can do it again?
No, honestly, I think it kind of takes any kind of pressure off. There's only a handful of guys that have won the Worlds twice. The second one vindicates or validates the first one. So kind of now I feel like it's okay to take a risk or do what it takes to try to win an event, and whether that works out or not. So I think the pressure's off. I really, really, really want to win it a third time. That's what kind of keeps me going. Pressure's off as far as needing to prove myself or justify my existence or any of that stuff. It's fun to just kind of show up and try to go get that trophy.
And so you've just earlier this year were at the Austrian pre-worlds, at the pre-world event, getting ready for the worlds next year.
Yeah.
You came third. Were you happy with that result?
Yeah, I think that I was tickled with that result, kind of based on the effort that we put into it. It was, I went in saying I'm not going to be super focused on the finish. I wanted to learn the area, fly in the area, figure out a great hotel to stay at, figure out shipping of balloons. It was a fantastic, gorgeous place to fly balloons. There were no fences. We didn't ask landowner permission. It was chilly weather, so we just had a great time. I was flying with my stepson in the basket, and we had the GoPro going. And so we were there. It was half vacation, half business trip. And I left there really looking forward to going back this next summer. And it was such a refreshing place to go fly. Our nationals in the United States the last handful of years have been in the South, and it's been super, super hot and humid and no afternoon flights. And so it was really nice to go to rolling hills and green grass and wearing a jacket in the morning. And it was just, and Claude, the director, did great. And they've got a nice facility. It's going to be pretty cozy there with 100+ balloons, but it was pretty spectacular place to go fly.
On the one of the things that I've always given advice to people that go to their first world championships or international competition is get the logistics right, because going into an event when you don't know where the restaurants are, where the hotels are, if your balloon's even going to make it to the country, is what can kill a competition for you, because you go in stressed. Have you had those sorts of experiences previously going to championships where things just logistically don't work out for you?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, that's the point of going to the pre-worlds, because I'm a worrier. I internalize everything. So for me to eliminate distractions and stress and anxiety, but going into Hungary was one that we didn't get there beforehand. So we showed up a week early. We didn't get to do very many competition flights. We thought we had a decent hotel sorted out, but we were kind of just making it up on the fly. But I do a lot better having been there a year before and having a good feeling for what we're getting ourselves into. And like you said, where we're going to go eat and which local beer we like and what vehicle we're going to rent, and knowing that the basket's going to fit in there, and kind of just eliminating all the things that can go wrong, because I like to start out the week, obviously, not stressed out and exhausted. And that's been such a great thing about going to the Worlds in Japan. They've got such a great organization over there, and going and flying in Saga every year, it's so simple to go to the airport, pick up the vehicle, go to the shipping place and picking up your balloon, and you can go fly the next morning, and you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to sweat the customs office and things like that. So eliminating any of those things, I definitely think helps.
Yeah, I learned that lesson at Battle Creek when we showed up at Detroit Airport, and the customs person said that our balloons would be ready in 5 days once they got through customs. I think the five Australian faces of horror made them turn it around in 4 hours.
Yeah, I guess we didn't pay them enough, because we told them to hold your balloons for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, actually, on a personal note, I think that was the Battle Creek event was actually one of the most friendly events that we'd been to in terms of just the support the US team had given all of the foreign pilots. So we greatly appreciated that from your side.
Yeah, and that was a great championship, other than the outcome from my point of view. But having the great weather and being able to fly so many times up there, and that was that was of all the world championships I've flown at, that's when I felt like I flew the best. And that was one that I feel like we let get away. But at the same time, Nick flew out of his mind, and he spent the week before that trying to help all the Japanese pilots. I think he ended up buying all their balloons and registering them and insuring them. And so he took a lot of stress before the event on, and then he was rewarded handsomely with his flying and won that year.
Must be a karma thing,
I guess, or a good distraction.
So on that, we were talking about this prior to recording, where we're sort of starting to feel like the old men of competition ballooning, and there's all these young bucks coming up. So, you know, and my classification of young is anyone under 40 these days. So you've got people like the Dom Barefords of the world. You've got Rokas and Remus. You've got Clement from France, even Matt Scaife and Nicolas Scaife coming in. What do you think these younger pilots are doing differently, and why are the old dogs starting to feel the pressure more from them?
There are a handful of guys that I'm starting to watch over my shoulder for sure, and that are winning these events. And I don't know, I think that technology comes easier. Back in the early 2000s, when the GPSs came out and we started flying with computers, I was the one that everybody walked up to with a GPS and a cord and asked if I'd load their waypoints or teach them how. I felt like I was putting on seminars about them before the balloon events. And now, man, that's what Rhett Hartzell does, all that stuff for me. He's the guy, and I'm just feel like I'm barely keeping up with Ozzie Target. And I kind of learned that kicking and screaming a little bit, and still don't feel like I know it like I should. And these other guys are the younger guys. It's second nature to them to have a laptop and an iPad and four GPSs and the FlyTech instruments and a GoPro and all of that technology. So that's where I feel like things have changed. I feel like I can fly to a target as good as I ever have, but keeping up with all of the outside stuff, it's helping. It's harder and harder. You're having to do better and better, get closer and closer each time, because the technology's eliminating the bad mistakes. So I think the next generation, the younger generation, is just maybe more familiar with that. The racers, we had to learn how to fly racers. Those are Dom Barefords probably never flown a fat balloon. So
he did actually in the Australian Nationals earlier. He came and borrowed, and we gave him a fat 77, and it certainly had an impact on his results.
I was going to say, I don't remember seeing his name at the top of the leaderboards.
He was in midfield. It was quite satisfying.
But it's kind of fun. I mean, I grew up we always kind of felt like the young bucks, and now, but on the other end, it's still fun to see Joe Hartzell and David Barefort. I think they've got one left in them. So it's fun to see the legends, if you will, still out there and giving all of us a run for our money.
So you mentioned that you were flying with your stepson at Austria earlier this year. Is he the next generation from your side?
Oh, he's got the ballooning bug, but he's more interested in the GoPro videos and editing them down and making movies. And he's off to college. So Sam is probably not the next generation, but there's a handful of guys, here in the States. I think they're getting ready to kind of break the door down and knock us all out of the way.
Well, on the GoPro front, I think that's the one thing that we all need to learn, is how to do a good selfie on top of a target. It seems to be, if you haven't got it on video, it doesn't count. So,
man, I get nervous when that GoPro's hanging on the balloon. It's distracting to me, and then I feel like maybe I'm trying to fly different to show off, because I want to make sure I get good video. So I can't take that thing with me during the competitions very often. It messes with me in some way, or at least I blame my bad flights on the GoPro maybe.
Yeah, well, one of the things I've found is, and because I mount a GoPro in the flying wise pointing down the basket, it's really interesting going back and analyzing your behavior in a flight. So watching when you do well versus when you didn't do so well, it's really interesting just seeing yourself in the basket, whether, you know, I've seen where I've just been frantically running around the basket, looking all over the place, and that's generally when I'm not doing well. But when you've got a cruisy flight, I just look relaxed in the zone. So that's where I've been using it a lot more these days, is just analyzing it.
Yeah, it's fun to watch Matt Scaife just running circles around the basket with his GoPro videos. If he'd shut that off, he'd do better.
We've been telling him that, but watching his tail wag as he comes closer to that target. Yeah,
he is like a puppy, isn't he?
But on the analysis side, you mentioned it earlier that you started doing things like writing down your tasks and looking at what you do better at and what your, you know, things where you can improve. So what did that look like, and is that something you still do?
I haven't done it for a while, but I remember in the 90s, I wrote down, I just did a chart of my scores and everybody that finished ahead of me, and whether it was a judge declared, a pilot declared, a fly on, an elbow, morning flight, evening flight. And I tried to see if there were any trends and weaknesses. And I quickly did realize that when it was a pilot declared goal, that's when I was falling behind, and evening flights were a nemesis, and they still are occasionally, but they were where I was really losing ground. So I tried to just standard sport. I tried to figure out what the problem was and then turn the weakness into a strength. And it's night and day difference. The two worlds that we've flown in, when I've gotten decent points at night, is when we've had a chance to win. And the same thing with the different tasks, but more than anything, it's when I can not fall behind with night flights is usually when we're in contention to win at the end of the week.
It's interesting you mentioned the pilot declared goal there, because one of the things that I've been doing recently is building this Watch Me Fly site, which allows us to analyze everybody's past results. And a bit of a on-the-spot quiz for you. Of all the tasks out there, which ones do you think are your best in the last few years, and which ones do you think are your weaker ones?
I would think that I'm better at the stuff that I get to pick. So pilot declareds and fly-ons versus going into a common goal with 100 other balloons would be a quick guess. I generally do pretty good on the 3D or the logger tasks. The last couple, I never do good on a race to a line or some kind of time task. It seems like those have kind of kicked my tail.
I don't think anyone can on those. That's interesting. You're pretty much spot on. So just looking at the numbers in front of me here, you're generally, of the tasks that you've done quite a few of, fly-ins and pilot declared goals are your better ones. And then hesitation waltzes and judge declared goals are still good, but not, you know, in the top 10 best results. But interesting enough, fly-ons are probably one of your least from a number perspective. But that trend is something that I've seen a lot, where some pilots are better at the things that they get to choose and plan, and then others are better when it's they're just told where to fly to.
Sure.
So, yeah.
I need to know more about where you're looking, because I need to go check this out.
Well, if you go to watchmefly.net, you can. I've pretty much got the last 4 years worth of competitions in there, and it's breaking each pilot down in their numbers. So, I'll put a link on the show notes to it. But it's certainly interesting just looking at different pilots and where their strengths are and where their weaknesses potentially are. And honestly, I built it just to analyze my own data, but I thought, well, I may as well pump everyone's data in there and see what happens.
Yeah, that's great. I can't wait to go look at that.
And because I know certainly a lot of the top pilots that I've talked to have done some sort of exercise where after a flight sat down, wrote down notes about each task, understood what they've done better. And is that something you've seen other pilots around, especially in the US team or at the top level, do different techniques for that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's common talk at the watering hole to kind of debrief. I know Joe Hartzell and Rhett Hartzell and I spend a lot of time talking about it. This last Worlds in Japan, I went in with a very specific strategy that I wanted to take off super early. I didn't care if there were any balloons in front of me. I did not want to get caught up in 100 balloons in the calm winds trying to fly into targets. So I made a conscious decision to go fast and hoping that things would change behind me. I felt like that was my best opportunity to win Japan. And looking back, our team, Joe, Rhett, and I, we made some really good decisions. We took off in the right spot pretty much all the time. But I was a touch too early, and I If I had it to do over again, I'd wait 10 minutes before I took off each day, because I ended up kind of being the having to go search for something first and then making it easier for everybody behind me. So that was an example of making a conscious choice of when I was going to launch and how I was going to approach the tasks. And with all that being said, I still ended up in the middle of a herd of balloons at Common Goals and getting stuck over the top of 50 balloons, and best laid plans never seem to work out.
And when it comes, you mentioned the races earlier. From watching you fly, I've seen you push the balloon, but I've never seen you regularly do what some of the other, again, I'll say the younger pilots generally do, where the balloon's constantly distorting one way or another. Is that something that you generally find you don't need to do, or is it something you, you know, personally just choose not to do?
No, I'll knock a balloon out of whack if I need be. I definitely do fly differently than I did 10 or 15 years ago. But I also figured out in the racer, if you let all the air out of them and fly them, try and fly them sideways, they don't go as fast as if you keep a little bit of heat in them and keep them pointed up and down. So I don't like kind of flying out of control. I've done it a few too many times. So I don't like going to the repair station. I don't like having new panels in the bottom of my balloon or stripes up my Nomex. So I do try to take care of my stuff, but I'll push it as hard as it can be pushed if that's what's necessary. But I just don't like to do it. I'm getting old.
Fair enough. So you mentioned Matai, that you really enjoyed it. Are there other locations or favorite competition locations that you've enjoyed over the years?
Well, from flying, just a privilege or a thrill to get to fly there. The World Air Games in Dubai were just ridiculous. Taking off, doing a splash and dash in the Persian Gulf and flying 10 feet over the tops of skyscrapers and watching camels trotting around tracks. It was just ridiculous, the things that we were allowed to do there. I really thought and really enjoyed the Worlds in 2004 down in Australia, until they actually started and we had horrible weather and we didn't get to fly. Yeah. Thought that was going to be a fun place. So I'm looking forward to coming back to Australia and maybe getting to redeem myself. But just any place we get to use a passport is just a thrill and a privilege. And I go back to Japan year after year. This is the first time in a long, long time we haven't been there. So just, I've made friends all over the world. I love, it's been fun. I hadn't been back to Europe in a while, or the last couple of years. So I got to go back there twice this summer and going back next summer. So it's just a thrill to go everywhere, really.
Something that I've been trying to work out how we can promote competition ballooning a little bit more around the world in terms of getting new people into the sport. And feedback I've certainly had from people who've come to a nationals in Australia is that, well, you know, it's kind of, there's the group of 10 at the top and there's no way we can ever get up there. So why bother? What sort of advice do you have for people who are, well, have you seen the same sort of thing in the US? And what sort of advice do you have for people to try and get into competition ballooning?
I don't know. I mean, I know one of the things that we've tried here in the United States, and I think that it's getting ready to fire up again, was a team championship. We had the idea was you had a kind of a seasoned, experienced competitive pilot, and you've got someone that's kind of middle of the road, and then your third participant or third team member is someone that's never really flown heavy duty competition. And the idea was that it would introduce people into the sport and kind of bring them along and show them the ropes. So I think that's getting ready to start up here in the United States again. I think that maybe brought a handful of people in. I'm seeing here in the United States, there's a couple areas. I know in Albuquerque or up in Colorado, there's some kind of smaller balloon clubs or balloon groups that people are trying to run just kind of little weekend competitions, and they'll bring in David Levin to call a task and put on a bit of a seminar, or Bubba Cliver's done that. And there's a handful of people that are kind of willing to share what they know. I've never found anybody to really have any secrets, except for maybe Al Nels back in the day, but that's a joke, Al. But pretty much everybody's approachable, and I think the big secret is there are no real secrets. It's just showing people what they got to do and just the confidence to go and let a pie ball go and decide this is a good place to launch and be willing to make a couple of mistakes. But I think it is up to all of us to try to bring somebody new into the sport and help bring them along for sure.
Well, I think you made the point before too, that, you know, you're often just grabbing people out of the crowd to help you out. And it still amazes me how, you know, often we are just desperately trying to find people to come and help out. And having crewed for many years at World Championships, it's almost in a way more fun than actually flying, because you learn so much on the ground.
Yeah, and I found some of the best crew are people that are pilots, but they're not really involved in the competition. And what better way to get them involved is to show them kind of the behind the scenes stuff, and that there really is no magic that goes on. Everybody lets pie balls go and runs around the countryside until they find a spot with permission to launch and take off and fly across the targets. And some days you do better than others, but I think it is a responsibility on all of us to just kind of let the sport grow and let it not get too complicated and keep it pilot friendly and just keep it going.
And when you're both combined with using your crew, but also just generally when you're flying towards a target, not necessarily at the target, how are you using your crew? What information are they generally providing you? Feel free to not tell me if you think this is secrets.
It's what they see. I love to get information from people that I trust, that have some experience, or I know what they're trying to say. So, whether it's another pilot or somebody on the ground, just what they see. And it as much as the big orange balloon's the closest one to the target, or if you fly over the tall tree upwind of the target, that's kind of the low wind line. If you look at like what Udai and his dad do, his dad's on the ground. He's able to see that wind line. Masa's got the experience that nobody else's ground crew has, because he used to do it. So just any kind of information like that's reliable, that can be relayed back to you. And I always say, as the pilot, tell me what you see, and it's up to me as the pilot to use that information or decipher it or decide if I want to use that information, because I don't want anybody to be scared of saying the wrong thing. So tell me what you see, and I just kind of put that in the washing machine and see if that's something that I use in the end of it. But just any the advanced wind information and just helping identify and find the target where we're trying to get.
And are you a numbers person? Do you like people reading you directions and speeds and things, or do you just prefer landmarks and things that are happening at the target?
It depends. Landmarks work pretty good for the way my brain computes. I like to, once I get the target in sight, I like to not look at the GPS, and I shut the lid on the computer and go back to kind of the old school spitting out the side of the basket and watching the balloon or two in front of you or behind you and just kind of picking your line and running through it. But everybody gives information differently. We share a lot of information balloon to balloon. We're all the time calling each other, asking what your track is and what your bearing is when you decided to go from 6,000 feet down to the target, and then deciding, do we want 10 degrees more or 10 degrees less of that? That's how, as pilots, we're really helping each other out.
And it's certainly something, a trend that I've seen more recently. And you mentioned it at Motegi in 2006, that you were working as a team and had a team manager. And it was certainly something for the Australian team that we did at the Worlds last year, was have a team manager and start working more as a team. Is that a trend that you think's going to continue with other teams now that we've seen success out of it?
Yeah, I mean, what you guys did in Australia, or the Australian team did in Japan last year, was intimidating, because you guys had so much experience on the ground. They're able to help the pilots. It made us look like what we were doing was nil. The U.S. team, I think we had 10 pilots, so 10 people can't all go do a pie ball and all go launch from the same spot. So we kind of naturally break up into kind of working groups, and we share a common frequency, but it ends up being two or three smaller teams just because of the numbers. But, just getting the right people around you that want to be there and they're excited and they want to help. And I'm sure from your standpoint, a lot of the guys on the ground, there wasn't much for them to do, but the one or two or three times during the week that they needed the help, they were invaluable. So yeah, I think you have to work as a team.
Yeah, and it's certainly having to be one of the people on the ground at the Worlds and sitting at a target for 4 hours, you also need a team of people with patience.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're wondering why in the heck are you there? You could be on a beach somewhere, or maybe it, I don't know, did it motivate you to get back and get back in the air? And I'm sure you probably had a lot of time to think about what you're doing right and what you can improve on.
Oh, no, I think I was too busy hanging out with Scott Armstrong from the American team.
Too much time in the gin bar, huh?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Pressure was off. One sort of final question was, just in general about, you know, have you used any techniques or read any books or listened to any particular motivational speakers or people that have just helped you get into the right sort of mindsets going into these sorts of events?
I pay a lot of attention to sport, different sports. Like tonight is game 7 of the World Series, and I don't have a big interest or rooting interest in either side, but I like watching the good players and see how they respond on the biggest of stages. I read some books of kind of sports psychology stuff over the years, but for the most part, I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on my emotions. It's fun to watch different pilots. There's some that fly great when they're angry. They fly great when they're relaxed. They fly great when they're hungover. So it's kind of as an individual, finding what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and putting yourself in the best situation and the best frame of mind to do so is kind of the biggest thing for me. I've learned over the years, I don't study the score sheets. I probably should look at them more. I barely pay attention to my scores because it really doesn't matter. It's not a game between the other people up until the last flight or two. So it's just, I just go out there and try to get as many points as possible on each task and just roll on to the next one and try to have a short memory. So like golfing or anything else, is I try to forget your last shot because it doesn't do you any good. You just have to focus on your next one.
Well, when you find a book that a book that teaches us how to be better sports people with hangovers, let me know. That could completely change the game, especially in Japan. Excellent. Thanks. Great. Well, I think that's probably enough for today. I would really like to thank you for your time and sharing all those tips and tricks for everyone.
It's been a pleasure. It's exciting to see the podcast, and I think your interest has been pretty overwhelming. So congratulations to you.
Yeah. So we've certainly committed ourselves to it now. I think it's once you get a subscriber list, you can't stop doing things. So what's next for you? Like, is it focusing on the Worlds next year, or are there other things in between that are taking up your focus?
Just life in general, but yeah, everything will be kind of timed out to where hopefully, by the time we're ready to go to Australia, we've got the right guys in place and the right plan in place and good weather. And yeah, that's
Did you just say Australia, not Austria?
Oh, I did say it. Sorry.
Yeah. You better make sure you check your tickets.
Yeah. I don't want to show up down under.
Exactly. No, great. Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you there, and obviously we'll be in touch prior to that, but it's hopefully going to be a great competition. From all the reports I've heard from everyone, the Austria event looks like it's going to be a lot different from the last Austria World Championships.
Yeah, you've got me confused. I'm talking to Australians about Austria, so forgive me. So it's going to be exciting. It's fun talking about competitive ballooning. It's fun to see the new guys coming along, and I can speak on behalf of the competitive pilots. I know that that if anybody has any questions, wants any ideas, thinks we have secrets, come and ask, because there are no secrets, and everybody I've ever approached is more than happy to share anything they know. So with that, I thank you much.
Great. Well, thank you, John. That's been really good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Take care.
Hi, it's Andrew here again. Just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to Auntie Monkey via the auntiemonkey.com website. We'll send out emails each time a new episode's made available. Plus, you can also subscribe via iTunes and your Android podcasting app. Please also remember to share Auntie Monkey on Facebook. We want to make sure we get the word out there, and so everybody in ballooning can enjoy the podcast. Thanks, and see you next episode.